Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP, FM, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forum series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, as you have probably heard, the incidence of autism has been increasing very rapidly in the U.S. in recent years. Just a few years ago, the often quoted prevalence rate of autism spectrum disorders was 1 in 166 children. Today, it stands at 1 in 110 and 1 in 70 for boys who are disproportionately affected by ASDs. As this epidemic has been going on, so has a virtual revolution in our understanding of this very complex set of neural disorders, including new ideas about detection, intervention, treatments, and even the tantalizing prospect that recovery is in fact possible. With so much going on in the world of autism and so much hope on the horizon, it's great to have as my guest this week on Radio In Vivo, autism expert Dr. Geraldine Dawson. Jerry is research professor of psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill, and she is also the chief science officer of the nation's foremost autism advocacy group called Autism Speaks. Jerry, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start at the beginning, and even the beginning is not such a simple question when it comes to autism. What exactly is autism? And welcome to our trains. We are our new studio is right here next to the train track, and we have the coal train going through, I think, to the power plant. I wanted to get you to just define autism for us and autism spectrum disorders.
Well, you're right. Autism is a very complex set of disorders. It's not one condition, but actually many different conditions. We often refer to this as the autism spectrum disorder mm-hmm. because there's so much variability in the way that autism presents itself. So some individuals have very severe impairments in the ability to communicate. They may never speak. Whereas other individuals may be out in the workplace and have families and relatively normal lives. The characteristics that bring this widely diverse set of disorders together are difficulties in the area of social interaction. So in a very impaired person, this may be manifest in no interest in other people, very little eye contact, the inability to read emotional cues, and to really form that social and emotional connection. Mm-hmm. At the other end of the spectrum, you have individuals who may be very interested in other people, may seek and really want to form social relationships, but they have difficulty in understanding the nuances of social interaction. They just can't decipher and understand social cues, and so they're very awkward, and actually this is can be very difficult for them and very distressing. So people with autism also, in across the spectrum, also tend to have a kind of a narrow range of interests and activities. So again, at the more severe end, you may find an individual who has very severe stereotype behaviors, spinning, rocking, collecting unusual objects. At the other end, a very high-functioning individual may be very much like most professors at the university. They have a narrow range of interest and kind of an obsessional focus on a particular topic. But when that obsession interferes with social relationships, the ability to carry on conversations, then you move into the realm of what we think of as the autism spectrum disorders.
I see. And when did we really start recognizing that the nature of the spectrum and calling autism spectrum disorders as opposed to just thinking of it as a single disease? How long has that been prevalent?
Well, the autism was first recognized as a clinical syndrome in 1943 by Leo Kanner, and he described what we think of as the classical autism condition, which is more of a severe form. As we began to study autism and to develop better methods for detection, we realized that people with autism have a range of intellectual ability. So in the 1980s, we started to broaden our concept of what autism is. And so since about the 1980s, we've really thought of it as a spectrum disorder, and the diagnostic criteria now reflect that variability.
I see. So what developments have contributed to our improved understanding of what ASDs are, even as now we're starting to get a more clear picture of the abnormal neurology that's involved?
Well, over the last several decades, as you said in the beginning of this program, it truly has been a revolution in our understanding of autism. And I've been in the field since the 1970s, so I've been able to witness this revolution.
And contribute,
I hope. It has really come from moving away from looking at autism as in purely psychological or behavioral terms to understanding it as a neurological condition. Mm-hmm. And understanding that it affects brain development. And now we're really even realizing it affects the whole body, the GI system, the immune system, the metabolic system. So as the technology and science of biology and neuroimaging and genetics have developed, we've applied these tools to really getting insight into the biological basis of autism, and we now recognize this as a neurodevelopmental disorder.
I see. Well, I also understand that that recent studies have actually cast some doubt on what had been a pretty interesting theory recently, that mirror neurons were playing a role in the dysfunction.
Right. So mirror neurons are a very interesting part of our brain. They're cells in our brain that fire not only when we enact certain motor activities, but also when we're watching other people. Mm-hmm. And so we think of these as the neurons that allow us to form a connection between what we ourselves do and what other people are doing. And there was a lot of interest in this in autism because we know that people with autism begin by having a profound impairment in the ability to imitate others, mm-hmm. and also to understand other people's body movements and to map those body movements onto their own body movements. So one of the ways that we understand things like emotions and gestures is by imitating those and experiencing those emotional and gestures ourselves. If you can't map that information, one from ourselves to the other person, then you're looking at the other person as something completely different, and you can't empathize, mm-hmm. and or even construct a sense of what the other person is feeling or experiencing. So there was a lot of interest in whether mirror neurons may underlie a core impairment in autism. And we do think that actually the mirror neuron system is affected.
Okay.
But we also are now realizing that it is one of those systems that as individuals have treatment, that we can, this system is not broken to the extent that we can't activate that system as we provide intervention. And one of the things that we do when we provide early behavioral intervention is we teach young children how to imitate other people, and they can learn to imitate. So as they learn to imitate, they're stimulating that, mirror neuron system, and we find that it can become functional. But of course, if you're not engaging in imitation, then that part of your brain is really not getting stimulation and isn't going to develop normally.
I see. You mentioned just a minute ago, Jerry, about the common association that has emerged of ASDs with other medical conditions, such as gastrointestinal problems, seizures, sleep disorders. I'm sure it's a lengthy list. What is all that telling us about autism itself?
Well, we began by thinking of autism as a behavioral and psychological condition. We moved to understanding it as a brain condition. Now we're really recognizing it as a whole body condition. And so one of the important implications of this is that when a child or an adult comes in to be evaluated, we need to be very sensitive to the fact that they may be experiencing a whole range of medical conditions that are affecting their quality of life.
Sure.
And as you mentioned, this could be GI problems, sleep problems, seizures, allergies. And one of the positive things about recognizing these conditions is that we do have treatments for these. And so whereas we're still kind of at the early stages, and we are making breakthroughs, but we still have difficulty in addressing the core autism in a fundamental way through treatment, we can affect quality of life immediately by addressing things like sleep problems and GI. So at Autism Speaks, one of the things that we have funded is something called the Autism Treatment Network. This is a network of 14 medical centers throughout the United States and Canada that are developing a model of comprehensive medical care. So every team has a multidisciplinary team that includes a sleep specialist, a GI doc, a pediatrician, as well as a psychologist, speech pathologist, and so forth. And so by having this broader team, we're able to address kind of the other conditions that go along with autism.
I see. And that, as you say, that must really improve quality of life.
Oh, amazing. Just let me tell you one little story.
Sure.
So I actually was the director of one of these Autism Treatment Network centers at the University of Washington before I returned here to North Carolina. And we had a teenager that we had been serving for a number of years. And this young man was having such difficulties. And he was a very high-functioning young man, good cognitive skills, should have been able to really having success in school. But instead, he was having so many behavioral challenges that he was being homeschooled. Mm-hmm. He was on several medications for what we thought were psychiatric conditions. When we started to bring in the sleep specialist, and the sleep specialist started to interview the mother, she said, you know, I think your son may have a pretty significant sleep condition, and I'd like to test him with an overnight, you know, EEG, and sure enough, he had very significant sleep apnea.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So he was treated for this, and honestly, it just turned his world around, and I saw what difference it can make to really address some of these conditions. He could pay attention, he returned to school, he was a much happier kid. So these are very, very important things to attend to.
Sure. And a sleep impairment would certainly directly affect cognitive
Absolutely.
Performance.
And there's been studies to show just that.
I imagine so. Well, it's very interesting that all that is coming to light, given, you know, I mentioned in my introduction that the current prevalence figures for autism. And I know that that has actually been the subject of some controversy in recent years, as some people have tried to kind of deny the idea that there's an epidemic of ASDs in the U.S., ascribing the rise to improved diagnostic techniques and simply increased attention by clinicians as well. How much of the increase in prevalence do you think can be explained away by those things? And by the same token, how much do you see an actual increase in incidence?
So you're right. There has been this really dramatic and I would say alarming increase in prevalence of autism over the last several decades. In fact, Since I began in the field, it's been an over 600% increase in prevalence.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And now, if we had another disease that was like that, it would be an all-out war.
That's right. That's right. And so, and many families are saying this, you know, this is a crisis. Mm. This is a public health crisis that we need to address with more research, more funds, with a very aggressive public health stance in trying to understand why we're seeing this increased prevalence. Mm-hmm. There now are some very nice epidemiological studies that are trying to parse apart, you know, what accounts for this increase in prevalence. And these studies are telling us that, in fact, some of this increase is due to better diagnosis.
Sure.
So earlier diagnosis, kids with milder symptoms, a broader diagnostic method in terms of what we consider autism. Mm-hmm. But when we account for all those variables in our model, we're still left with this extra increase. Something like 25 to 50% of the increase is unexplained.
Sure.
And that's why the NIH, Autism Speaks, and other science funding organizations are very interested in the role of the environment. What may have contributed this that may be environmental? Mm-hmm. We know that autism is caused by genetics to some extent. Genetics play a very important role, but these genetic susceptibilities may be interacting with environmental factors that have changed over the last several decades. So we need to understand the role of the environment. And so there's quite a bit of interest and scientific activity in that area right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've heard it explained, not only describing autism, but other diseases as well. Genes load the gun, the environment pulls the trigger.
Yes, that's one way of thinking about it.
Well, there certainly is a lot of progress in recent years also on our understanding of the etiology of ASDs, the causes of the disorders. Enlighten us about some of the new developments there, because I do want to go into some detail about the genetics and the environmental factors as well.
Okay, so one of the reasons why it's been difficult to understand the etiology of autism is because it's not one condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's many mm-hmm. different conditions.
As we've discovered with cancer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There are many complex diseases where when we began, we thought of these as one condition, and then we realized that it's many different conditions and that will involve many different types of treatment approaches as well.
Sure.
So this is what we're discovering in autism as well. So we're not going to find, you know, a cure. We'll find many cures and many treatments and prevention approaches. We have been able to identify specific genetic etiologies for about 10 to 15% of cases. So, for example, Fragile X is a genetic condition that affects the X chromosome, mm-hmm. where we know that the risk of developing autism is about 30%. So 30 to 40% of people with Fragile X syndrome will develop autism.
Right.
There's other sure. conditions like that.
And that also causes retardation.
That's right. It causes mm-hmm. mental retardation as well. Mm-hmm. There's other conditions like
Those are kind of the easy ones.
Those are the easy ones. Those right. are the ones where we can say, here's a single gene, here's a mutation, mm-hmm. it resulted in autism. So there's about 10 to 15% of cases where we're discovering those kinds of causes.
Okay.
The other cases are ones in which we're looking at multiple genes that cumulatively interact to cause autism and then interact with genetic or environmental factors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other discovery of late is that we're finding that autism can result from a number of rare mutations. So the first model of the genetics of autism was that the genetic characteristics were characteristics that the general population had. So we were looking at sort of the far end of a continuum of the normal distribution of genetic variability.
Okay.
And it just so happened that people with autism carried those variants at the far end of the continuum of impaired social behavior, impaired communication. The new genetic findings are a very different model, which is that, in fact, autism appears in most instances to be related to very rare genetic mutations that do not show up in the general public, and that there are many, many types of rare mutations that can result in autism. And at first this was a bit overwhelming, because if you thought, well, there's so many different rare mutations that could result in autism. But the interesting thing is that many of these mutations are clustering around the same biochemical systems in the brain.
Okay.
So we are now using these findings to map what biochemical systems in the brain may be affected. These biochemical systems can be affected by many different genes,
sure.
but in all cases or most cases, they're affecting only a kind of a handful of different neurotransmitter systems in the brain.
Okay.
So this is hopeful, because it's leading us now.
That's something you can get a handle on,
absolutely.
Right?
And so genetics really has provided a window for us into the biochemistry of autism. And now there's a lot of interest in by pharmaceutical companies and scientists in developing medications that could restore the functioning of these biochemical systems.
Sure.
And so that's a very exciting point in the science right now, and it provides a lot of hope.
That's great. Well, so it may not really matter ultimately what the genetics specifically are.
Well, I think it'll always matter, and the reason why is that what we believe will happen to healthcare is that we'll move to a model of personalized medicine.
Sure.
Where, in fact, part of the diagnostic assessment will be very detailed genetic testing. And that based on the genetics, and as well as other factors, the environmental exposures, medical conditions, you'll get a very individualized approach to treatment. Because as I said, the genetics are pointing to a handful or a number of biochemical systems. So you'd still have to figure out for this individual what's the right medication, what's the right approach to help them to function as best as they can. So genetics will still be important.
So once we get to the point which everybody says is coming in not too distant future, that you know, having your own genome sequenced will be part of routine medical care.
Well, that's exactly where we're heading.
Yeah, so
absolutely.
All that will emerge then from that kind of scan.
That's our hope.
Well, that sounds great. And I would assume that by then we'll also have a better handle on, you know, who are carriers of mutations and, you know, how that all plays out.
That's right.
Generationally.
That's right.
And I understand that some of these changes that are involved are actually epigenetic, that are passed, you know, in the interaction of the genome and the system.
That's right. So there's a lot of interest in not only the genes themselves, but what are the factors that affect gene expression. And we know that genes require certain kinds of environmental activity. Some of this activity is biological, other of it is experiential, for the genes to be expressed in the normal manner. So this is a whole new field of epigenetics that's there's a lot of activity going on. There's a number of studies that are looking for epigenetic markers in autism to understand the role of various environmental factors that could be influencing gene expression.
I see. So it really sounds like I've done a couple of shows about this recently, a systems biology.
Absolutely.
Approach.
That is the approach that's being taken. In fact, the approach is to look at the range of genetic mutations that we see, and then to use a systems biology approach to map those onto specific biological systems in the brain, and then to develop medications that could hopefully help those systems to recover or in some way function better.
That's going to be well worth watching over the next few
years.
Yes,
and I would say that in the area of Fragile X, so the simpler conditions that lead to autism, we're already at the point of identifying what the underlying systems are. So, for example, in Fragile X, we know that glutamate is playing a major central role.
That's a neurotransmitter.
And that is a neurotransmitter. And we are at the point now of conducting human clinical trials that are examining how medications that influence the level of glutamate activity in the brain, how this can then help people to behave better in cognitive ability, social ability, communication. Mm-hmm. So this is a whole new era of science in autism, and one that's filled with so much hope.
Absolutely. Well, before we let the genetics go, I want you to tell me a little bit about the Autism Genome Project, which I know that you played a major role in and were lead author on, and has been quite revealing.
Yes. So the Autism Genome Project has been a project that the National Alliance for Autism Research, which was a former private foundation that funded autism research and then became merged with Autism Speaks. And then Autism Speaks took over the funding of the Autism Genome Project. So this has been a project that originally was funded by the National Alliance for Autism Research, now is funded by Autism Speaks. Mm-hmm. And the idea here was that there were many geneticists throughout the world studying autism, and they each had their own database. And we knew that that autism was very complex, and that the only way we were going to sort through this complex problem was to have a very large database of families and genetic material. And so it was actually Dr. Andy Scheer, who is a vice president now of scientific affairs at Autism Speaks. He went around all over the world and talked to each one of these groups. In fact, at that time, I was at the University of Washington, and he approached me and Dr. Jerry Schellenberg, who's a molecular biologist, and said, what do you think about taking your data and combining it with everyone else's so we can pull together what is the largest data set of genetics and autism? And people agreed. I mean, they knew that the only way to solve this problem was to collaborate. So endless conference calls later and negotiations, we created this major database with 50 different institutions involved. And it has become really a driving force in the field of autism genetics, and has resulted in a number of major breakthroughs and discovery of genes, and really has helped to give this a tool to understand and have insight into the biology of autism.
And how much of a contribution has there been from, you know, the advances just in the last few years, really in computational power and, you know, high-throughput methodologies?
Well, just the technology behind genetics is moving so quickly. We started out with what we call markers, where we probe, you know, the chromosomes and try to understand whether conditions are linked to specific parts of the chromosome. Now we're sequencing the entire genome. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to look in such detail. And then with large data sets, we're now, I think, finally at the point where we're going to be able to discover this whole set of genes that put a person at risk for autism. And that will also give us insight into what may be the important environmental factors, because it'll point in certain directions.
Sure.
Whether it's the immune system, dealing with toxins, mm-hmm. or other aspects of the environment, it goes hand in hand and gives us insight where to look in the environment.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the environmental side of things. Is there an emerging feel for how that gene-environment interaction actually works to impair neural development? Is it suspected that it's perhaps a lot of it is fetal exposures to chemicals?
We're still, I would say, at a very early stage. Mm-hmm. Right now, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and Autism Speaks is launching a major collaborative effort on the environment and autism, beginning with a couple of meetings that we're having this year to launch this initiative, and then the funding of new projects in this area. There are some interesting emerging findings, though, and they do, in some cases, have to do with the prenatal or early perinatal period of development. So, for example, we know that exposure to maternal infection during pregnancy raises the risk for autism as well as other neurodevelopmental conditions.
And that's a particular windows of development, even, isn't it?
That's right. Mm-hmm. We know that many of the changes that we see in the brain that are associated with autism are ones that have to do with development during the prenatal period. Mm-hmm. So we're very interested in that period. The other interesting finding. It has to do with prematurity. So babies who are born low birth weight or premature are at higher risk for autism. You might think of this as if you had a genetic susceptibility to a neurodevelopmental disorder, and then you had the stress of, you know, early birth and, you know, or early even birth trauma. So these kinds of factors can play a role. Mm-hmm. The other interesting finding has to do with the age of the parent. So we're finding that advanced parental age also may contribute to risk for autism. We also know that advanced parental age is associated in general with a higher risk of neurodevelopmental disorders, but this has been replicated a number of times now that it's also associated with risk for autism.
I see. Would you envision at some point down the road that there would be prenatal screening of some sort, as we have for other conditions already?
Well, prenatal screening is not on our radar, and one reason is that the kinds of etiologies, again, are ones that would raise the probability that a child will develop autism, but they aren't necessarily diagnostic.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we know that for many people with autism, you know, these are very positive characteristics. I mean, there are things to celebrate about mm-hmm. autism, particularly in a high functioning individual. We really think of the early detection as a way of preparing the parent to help that individual to develop, you know, to their optimal potential.
Sure, sure. Well, I understand that there actually has been remarkable progress in the ability to detect the presence of ASDs, even to the point that a diagnosis can now be made well before the appearance of any clinical symptoms. Those symptoms, I know that, you know, the classical thought is that the child reaches an age of about 3 and you start to detect problems, and even to the point of seeing regressions in reading ability and things like that. But I know that it's been a step forward that even as young as 18 months, you now can diagnose autism?
We're getting better and better. When I first started in the field, autism traditionally was diagnosed between ages 3 and 5, mm-hmm. if the child was detected early.
Sure.
Since that time, there have been two methodologies that have allowed us to understand how autism emerges in very young infants. One is home videotapes, and I did a lot of this work in our lab where we studied the home videotapes of the parents had taken of their babies, and when we went back and we looked at the baby's early development, we noticed that you could see symptoms even in a 1-year-old or a 10-month-old.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't necessarily the full autism, but even in an 8 to 10-month-old baby, this baby was not orienting when their name was called. The baby was not engaging in the kind of the early babbling. And then as the baby developed to age 1, was not pointing or showing things to their parent, not making eye contact in the normal way.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
then we began to realize that autism starts very early. The second methodology has involved prospectively following infants who are at risk for autism, so that we can understand how it emerges. And because of the genetics of autism, we know that if you have one child in the family with autism, the risk for the second child is about 18%. So about 18% of the time, the second child will develop autism. There's that train again.
I hear that whistle blowing.
So there are many studies now that are ongoing that are following babies prospectively who have an older child in the family with autism.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've learned from this is that below 6 months, there are very few behavioral symptoms. But between 6 and 12 months, many babies start to develop symptoms before the full syndrome is manifest. Mm-hmm. And again, these are failing to orient when their name is called, use of gesture, lack of eye contact.
Now, are these things that, that parents can detect, or does it take the trained eye?
Well, you know, sometimes parents do detect this. Mm-hmm. In fact,
probably a vague feeling of something isn't quite right.
Right. And one of the things that we strongly recommend is that if parents do have concerns, that they trust their instincts. Mm-hmm. Because when a parent does have a concern, that tends to predict that, yes, something is wrong.
Okay.
And so what often will happen, unfortunately, is the parent will be concerned, take the child to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician will say, you know, let's just wait and see. It's a boy. Boys talk late.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so then they'll wait maybe another 6 to 12 months, and then it takes time to get in to see the specialist, and it takes more time to get in to, for intervention, and you lose sometimes 2 to 3 years of very important time where the child could be in receiving early treatment. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. our goal now is to be able to certainly screen by 18 months. And in fact, the American American Association of Pediatrics, Academy of Pediatrics, has recommended that all babies be screened for autism at their 18-month well baby checkup.
Oh, that was my next question.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes,
sure.
So there are some very nice and very easy screening tools. These are questionnaires you can ask parents mm-hmm. that have to do with questions like, you know, is your baby making eye contact? How does your baby play with toys? These are very simple questions. And then if the mother is or father is telling you that, yes, the baby has a certain number of symptoms, then they should be referred for a full workup and diagnostic assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So we really hope that pediatricians will begin using these in their clinics for every 18-month-old. But you can go on the Autism Speaks website and see this screener if you have concern about your own baby,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and actually take the screener yourself and bring it into your pediatrician, show them.
Okay.
Because we know that if you begin early behavioral intervention early in life, this can have a very profound impact on the outcome. And so we want to have those babies referred as soon as possible.
Indeed. Well, I know that early intervention is one of your pet subjects, and I want to be able to get your wisdom about that. I know that you were lead author in a major study in 2009 in pediatrics, talking about this randomized controlled trial that was carried out of a comprehensive autism treatment that works for children as young as 18 months, mm-hmm. called, correct me if I'm wrong, the Early Start Denver Model?
That's right.
Okay. Tell us about that.
The Early Start Denver model was derived from a model that's been referred to as the Denver model that Sally Rogers, is a colleague of mine who's now at the Mind Institute at the University of California, Davis,
mm-hmm.
She has been developing the Denver model for over a couple of decades. And this was a model of early intervention for preschool age children. And in fact, there have been a number of randomized clinical trials of comprehensive behavioral intervention for preschool age children that have shown positive results in terms of improving children's cognitive ability, their language ability, and even some of their adaptive behaviors, such as, you know, dressing, feeding, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So what we wanted to do, Sally and I together, was to extend her model downward so that it would be appropriate for children actually as young as 12 months of age. In this particular study, the youngest child was 18 months. But since we now have screeners at 18 months of age, and in fact, we're now developing screeners for autism for 12-month-olds. Autism Speaks is funding a study that's being conducted by researchers here at the University of North Carolina. Steve Resnick and Grace Baranek have developed a screener called the 12-month inventory, a first-year inventory that can be provided at 12 months. So if we're telling parents your child, you know, may have autism or does have autism, is at risk for autism at 12 and 18 months, you have to be able to provide them with some kind of intervention.
Sure.
So Sally and I wanted to extend the early Denver model to become the Early Start Denver model. This model is based on the idea that language and learning develop in the context of a social relationship. So we very much focus on developing a positive social and emotional relationship between the child and an adult in the beginning, and then this is also we bring in peers and other children. And then in the context of that relationship, we use the science of what's called applied behavior analysis, which is a technical term for a strategy of teaching specific skills, behavioral skills, and using the principles of learning and positive reinforcement to teach children to be able to speak and make eye contact and all the things that they need to learn. Mm-hmm. So we're really pulling together kind of two types of therapy. Before this, there were kind of two brands of therapy out there. One was the applied behavior analysis, or what we call ABA, mm-hmm. Which tended to focus specifically on the principles of learning and teaching children these individual skills. But this was often done in more of a drill-like fashion, where you were just prompting the child over and over to use certain skills. And sometimes these did not generalize to the natural environment because they were taught in such a regimented way. Mm-hmm. Then at the other end, we had the so-called relationship or developmental approaches, which were focusing more on establishing a relationship. And Sally and I really felt that both of those were important.
Sure.
So this model tries to and does integrate those two approaches. And it really builds all of the skills across the wide domains of development. So social interaction, language, cognitive ability, self-help skills, motor skills. I mean, I think of it as really building the child. Mm-hmm. Because many mm-hmm. of the children, when they begin intervention, they're not making eye contact, they're not speaking, they're not playing with toys. They may not even be able to sit and attend and play functionally with an object for any length of time. So you're really teaching the child how to learn and how to interact and how to absorb information from the environment. And so we have a very comprehensive curriculum. We train parents to use this so that they're using it during their regular activities at home. And then we have a team of therapists that works with the child. It's about 25 hours a week of one-on-one treatment.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And in this particular study, we provided the intervention for 2 years. And we compared it to the interventions that children receive in the community. So we had a kind of community control comparison, and these kids were in a variety of preschool programs or other kinds of programs that were available in the community.
So the controls were getting some sort of intervention, but just not this particular one.
Right. Okay. In fact, all the children in the study were evaluated, provided with a diagnostic assessment and a set of goals and a treatment plan.
Okay.
And the children in the community group then were referred to the available resources in the greater Seattle area, because this was conducted at the University of Washington. And then the children in the Early Start Denver model were provided intervention through our program.
Okay.
What we found was that the children who received this intervention had a significant and dramatic gain in their cognitive ability. So their IQ gain was, on average, 18 points,
wow.
which is more than a standard deviation.
Sure.
Meaning that really many of the kids, the majority of kids, were functioning in the mental retardation or developmentally delayed range at the beginning of the study, and by the end of the study, many of those kids had moved into the normal range.
Okay.
They had significant advances in their language ability, both expressive and receptive, in their motor skills, in their adaptive behavior. And children in the treatment group also had a milder diagnosis, were more likely to have a milder diagnosis. So all the children were still on the autism spectrum,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but they were more likely to have a milder form of autism. So we were really thrilled that the results were as positive as they were. And the study, which was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, is now being conducted at three different sites in a multi-site randomized clinical trial. So,
it's being extended, a much larger sample. Replication.
Yes, replication.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds very encouraging in and of itself. And that's not a large drug regimen or anything like that. That's just simply applying this model that you described.
Yeah, I do have to make a point here that I think is really important, though.
Sure.
And that is that at the same time that we are developing effective early interventions, and the Early Start Denver model is one model, but there are other models out there that have been shown to be effective as well.
Mm-hmm.
There still are major, major barriers in families having access.
I was going to ask you about that, because that 25 hours a week, and that was in the controls, right? And how many hours a week one-on-one time in the...
No, 25 hours a week for the children receiving treatment.
That was it,
yes.
In your
uh-huh.
model. Okay, but that's
right.
Still, that's a lot of...
Yes.
That's a lot of resources being expended.
Right.
Socially, where do you see that going?
Well, the barriers to access are many, and one of them, one of the biggest ones, is financial.
Sure.
Because many insurance companies do not pay for early intervention services. And in fact,
what a surprise.
What a surprise. Which is, it's so short-sighted, because
yeah.
There have been cost-benefit analyses conducted, and even if you look at it strictly from a financial point
mm-hmm.
of view,
mm-hmm.
The estimated cost savings is about $1 million per child, because
sure.
children who are doing better end up not having to access as many services in the schools. They go on to become more productive citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They're not as much of a burden in terms of adult care, which is really the major burden
mm-hmm.
And
sure.
financially for autism care.
Right.
So even though it is costly, we think these are estimated to cost somewhere between $25,000 to $50,000 a year. So if you're looking at 2 or 3 years, $75,000 to $100,000 investment early on.
Mm-hmm.
But the savings, $1 million, that's a pretty good outcome.
Right. Well.
But so insurance does not pay in many cases. So Autism Speaks has been involved in a major lobbying effort to end insurance discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact,
will healthcare reform weigh in on that at all?
We were hopeful mm-hmm. That this would be included as part of the health care reform package, but unfortunately, it ended up. Was on the cutting block and did not get included. So
mm-hmm.
instead, what we've been doing is going state by state throughout the United States, and Autism Speaks works with each individual state. In fact, right here in the North Carolina, there's a lot of activity that's going on in terms of trying to pass legislation to and end insurance discrimination here in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So far, 23 states have passed legislation to end insurance discrimination.
Excellent.
And so those families now have access to intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're also looking at professional training, because we have to have enough providers and
mm-hmm.
enough
mm-hmm.
providers that really can do a good job, and quality is important.
Absolutely.
So we have a long ways to go, but
well, it's I certainly in North Carolina it makes absolute sense that should go through. This state, the research that has been carried out in this state has been on the cutting edge of this this condition for a long time. Gary Mesabov, I had on my show 4 years ago. In the TEACH program,
mm-hmm.
Has been right there at the cutting edge.
That's right. In fact, Eric Chopler and Gary Mesabov, they are true pioneers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When Eric Chopler, who began the TEACH program here at the University of North Carolina, started his work, back in the 60s and 70s,
right.
The idea of having parents as therapists, which is part of the TEACH model, was truly revolutionary. This was in the day when parents were being blamed for their child's autism.
Right, bad mothering.
Bad mothering. And Eric Schaffer stood up and said, no, parents aren't to blame. And in fact, you know, they can provide and be partners in the therapy process. And so Teach has been really just a pioneer in so many ways. And then we also have the excellent work of Joe Piven, Professor Joe Piven, and he's done much work on the area of genetics and neuroimaging. And in fact, he's heading one of these studies that are following infants prospectively and studying their early brain development to see whether we can detect autism even before those behavioral signs by looking at changes in brain development.
Okay.
So we have a lot going on right here in the Triangle area in the area of autism.
Well, and we are justly proud of that.
Yes, absolutely. Should be.
My guest on Radio in Vivo today is Dr. Jerry Dawson, and she is a research professor at UNC Chapel Hill and chief science officer of Autism Speaks. Jerry, the hour is dwindling down already, believe it or not, but I certainly don't want to let any more time pass before we start talking about the area of treatment, because there is so much going on there as well and so many exciting developments. I understand that there is really a real possibility that there will eventually be a cure for this condition. I so hesitate to use that word because it's so thrown about and abused. But in this case,
yes. Well, you know, our overall goal is to reduce the suffering that's associated with autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for some people, this is means more acceptance of who they are. You know, with their wonderful gifts and their artistic ability, and their special way of being able to think and operate in the world. For other individuals, they do indeed want a cure. And so we are really trying to address that whole broad range of ways that we can address suffering associated with autism.
Mm-hmm.
In the area of treatment, what we are striving for are kind of three things. One is the behavioral interventions, which I've already mentioned, providing them earlier and doing everything we can through behavioral interventions to give people the best chance for the best outcome.
Sure.
The second is we talked about the addressing the medical conditions, something we can do right away.
Right.
And then the third very, very exciting area is the idea of developing medications that could address the core autism. And we do believe that now that we are understanding the biology of autism and the biochemistry of autism, that we may be able to eventually develop medications that could reverse or help a person recover from their autism. In some of the animal models where they are testing these medications, one of the surprises is that in an adult animal model who now has, say, the syndrome of Fragile X syndrome, because mm-hmm. They can knock out that gene and create it in an animal model,
sure.
And then they're testing these medications, they found even in the adult animal model, they can recover the animal to virtually full functioning. Well, mm-hmm. So this is a very different view, because we thought you would have to provide this medication early in life for it to make a difference. But mm-hmm, we're actually mm-hmm. seeing in the animal models that you can provide these medications late, and it has a profound impact on learning ability and social interaction and so forth. So
and it's all about the synapses, right?
It's all about the synapses. So when we talked about the biochemistry and the idea that the genes are clustering around specific biochemical systems, these systems have to do with how neurons communicate with each other, the synapse. And what we're finding is, in order for the connection between neurons, the synapse, to function properly, there has to be a proper balance between excitatory influences and inhibitory influences of neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we're finding that in autism, there's an overabundance of certain neurotransmitters, so there's too much excitation. So essentially what these medications are doing is trying to modulate that excitation so the synapse can function properly.
Sure.
And if it can function properly, then we're hopeful then that the brain can begin to operate in more of a normal manner. So mm-hmm. As I said, we're already at
the
point.
And that's the same approach that's being taken with retardation. And,
yes.
And I would assume several other of the neural disorders, seizure disorders, I would assume.
Absolutely. Parkinson's. Alzheimer's, yes. Yeah. Yes. All of these neurological conditions are really benefiting from the advances in science. And we're now able to use this information to design medications that could directly affect the way the brain functions. So I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see some pretty amazing breakthroughs. And one of the exciting things, too, is that because of the new emerging science, pharmaceutical companies are gaining interest. So we see Roche and Pfizer and Novartis and many of the major pharmaceutical companies for the first time are entering into the area of autism because they see that there is this potential for developing these medications that could have a profound effect.
And they're all about meeting unmet medical needs.
Absolutely. Well, you know, they're the ones that make the drugs. So we, you know, you have the academics that are doing the science, but then at some point you have to partner with the pharmaceutical companies in order to bring that drug to market. And that's exactly the kind of partnerships that Autism Speaks is forming right now in order to develop those drugs. So we're very excited.
That's terrific and very exciting, and it's going to be wonderful to watch, and we're going to have you back for sure.
Well, it would be my pleasure.
We've got just a couple of minutes left, Jerry, and I want to spend that time hearing a little bit more about the research portfolio that you oversee at Autism Speaks, and a little bit about your own work at UNC Chapel Hill.
Well, let me just talk about Autism Speaks.
Please do.
So we are, as you mentioned in the beginning, the world's largest science and advocacy organization for autism. We have four main goals. One is advocacy, and we do a lot of legislative work and trying to improve the quality of life through advocacy efforts. The other is raising awareness. So you may have seen some of our ads in the newspapers and on the radios because people need to understand what autism is. And
sponsoring a race car.
Yeah, sponsoring a race car because we want to dispel the myth and have people recognize and to really understand the needs of people with autism.
Sure.
And then the third is we provide help in family services, so family service grants. We have a program called Autism Cares for people who are in great financial crisis. And then finally, the core program is science. So the majority of our program budget does go to science. So we provide somewhere between $20 and $30 million annually in science funding, really across the range from basic discovery, work on genetics and animal models, and all the way to treatment studies, both behavioral and pharmaceutical, and then dissemination. How do we get this information out into the community? And so the science of dissemination. So all the way from discovery to delivery, we're funding science at Autism Speaks. And we very much depend upon the donations of people in the community to drive this work. And then here at UNC, I'm on the faculty, and I get to spend time with all of the great researchers here and to interact with Joe Piven and his group. And I'm carrying on my work in early intervention. And so I'm just really blessed to have both of these positions and to, you know, do my small part in helping people with autism.
Well, I think our listeners will well understand that that is no small part, having heard you for the last hour, and we sure appreciate you being on Radio en Vivo today.
Well, it was my pleasure.
And we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks. So we do encourage you to check the website, radioenvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And please join us again next time, and the train, who has been going back and forth for the whole hour. Join us again next time for Radio en Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill.